Do you know what 50 mile an hour wind feels like when on the flats in Belize? Let me go completely off topic here and ask you, have you any style, or is style important to you? And when was the last time you fished with one of those super old guys? You know, that guy that's about your grandpa's age and has done just about everything in fly fishing? My guest today is going to touch on all these topics today and is going to share with us some tips to assure you have an amazing time on your travels and fly fishing this year. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where I show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that big trip, and what you can do to give back to the fish species you love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fishing since I was a little kid. I grew up around a fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers than just about anyone in the world. David Coggins, author of The Optimist and The Believer, and an authority on men's style and fashion, is here to help us improve our game this year. Today, you will get an inside view of what it was like for David to write his most recent book while traveling to Patagonia, Cuba, Belize, over across to Norway and back. We're going to hear some inside scoop and some good stories on this. Plus, we're going to get David's best tips on writing, and he's going to chime in on his take on AI and whether it's going to take over the world. You know, my style can always get a little help, so happy to have David back on the show. Time to podcast with David Coggins. How you doing, David?
Great, Dave. Nice to be here.
Yeah, good to have you on the show. We're going to do a little check-in episode here. We had you on, trying to think now, it's been a little while on the podcast. Give us a little heads up since we had you on last. What's been going on? We've had a number of authors. I know, you know, I always go back to John Gearock because he's, you know, kind of one of the most famous, probably fly fishing. And I know, you know, John, but, you know, I remember him talking about, like, you know, the books, you know, his next book. He used to do two at a time. You know, he's done two at a time, but he always does one now. How's that look for you? Give us the update on your books.
Well, yeah, John's sort of a hero in that regard. He just cranks them out and they're always great. I don't quite work with that level of facility. It's sort of like the guides who go out every day and I'm like tired after a week. So I think the last time we spoke, I was talking about my book, The Optimist, which is like my first book about fly fishing. And now I've got another book out that's called The Believer, which is sort of about a year of fishing. It kind of, the idea came to me after, well, during COVID when we were inside. It seems like a long time ago now. And I wanted to kind of do as much fishing as I could for a year before kind of I was settling down with my girlfriend, and who knew if I would be able to go on these trips. Then, of course, kind of the pandemic came back, so a lot of the trips were canceled. New Zealand was out. Japan was out, but I managed to get on the water anyway. And so this book is sort of about that.
Right on. I just looked back at it. It is episode 254. So it was quite a while ago. Yeah. We're going to be pushing kind of 3 years since our last chat. It's amazing how fast that went.
A book every 3 years is good for me.
Is that about right? Is that your cadence?
It's like, it's a funny thing. It's like you come up with an idea, you work with your agent and your, you know, publisher and editor, and then it kind of comes into focus. And then you do your research, which in this case was fishing, which is very fun. And then you're kind of in private while you work on it. And then it's very public again. You're working with your editor, with book designers. And so it's a little bit like coming back into the Earth's atmosphere or something, where you think, oh, I'm used to being on my own every day. And then all of a sudden you're on emails with nine people CC'd and what about this, and marketing meetings and you know, at some point you got to embrace that, because I don't think anybody's getting into the book business to make a lot of money, but then you got to play the game and get on social media and actually doing podcasts, which I enjoy very much. So it's great to talk to you.
That's right. So you do a few of these podcasts. Is that something, I mean, there's a number of them out there, and in your space, you're not exactly just all fly fishing all the time. Right. Maybe talk about that a little bit. What are you kind of known for out there other than some of these books?
Well, I've written a lot about travel over the years and men's style, and I've had a couple books about that. So when those books came out probably 7 or 8 years ago now, I did podcasts with kind of guys who talk a lot about style. And when it comes to fishing, I've been on Rosenbauer's podcast for Orvis. And I mean, I love to talk, you know, I don't know how it is in your life, but if I find someone who fishes a lot, I'm ready to kind of go into the corner with them and, oh my God, you've been steelheading, tell me about it. But then the people in the rest of my life are like rolling their eyes, and it's like, they just want to know how your fishing was. Was it good or bad? Are you in a good or bad mood? They don't need to know if you used 12 pound leader for a bonefish or a gotcha or a crazy Charlie.
That's right. That's right. That is pretty interesting. Yeah, the people that aren't as addicted to the fly fishing as we are, they don't quite understand it. But maybe that's like anything that you're into, right? Some of these things.
Yeah, I think I always feel like when I'm writing about fishing that you're not, the people who love fishing are going to understand the obsession. But what I try to communicate to people who aren't, or maybe only fished a little bit, is like the fishing can be specific, but the kind of obsession is universal. And I think a lot of people can connect with that, even if they, you know, love sailing or obsessed with hiking or some other thing or cooking. It could be anything, ceramics. And I think that's a universal desire. And I think that's what I try to communicate, that how do we allow ourselves to be taken over by fishing? And I think hopefully some people can relate to that.
Nice. Well, and I want to talk more about the book, and we'll dig into that here. A couple of the things I was thinking about, and we do have a lot of new listeners coming in all the time to the podcast. And I was kind of thinking, like, you know, the three reasons, if you had to have like kind of a couple of a take home message, but three reasons to test out fly fishing, right? Why would somebody want to get into this? Because there's a possibility it's going to become an addiction. Right. So I wanted to think about that a little bit as we go. So maybe just start there. Is that something that you think about a little bit with people that are new and out there in your audience? And how do you get them into fishing and all that?
Of course. I mean, I'm sure this happens to you. The more you fish and as you get older, you kind of like to bring your friends into it in a way. I think that's natural as you, I mean, I'm in my late 40s, but that if I have a friend who comes fishing with me in the Catskills and they catch their first trout, I get very excited, and things start coming out of my mouth. I never would have thought. We're like, rod tip up, keep the pressure on. I'm like one of those crazy, you know, coaches for school kids, where I'm like, oh, right, that's why people are like going nuts at the T-ball or something. So I mean, the first thing about fly fishing is it's an outdoor sport, right? And we all know that it's like by definition, but you're outside when you're doing it. And I think, you know, we're on our phones, we're online. When you go fishing, you step away from that. You're in this, like, you're not on the feed and follow or doom scrolling or getting the latest updates. You're kind of outside the hum of that, the intensity of that. And that's a great thing. And I think that's something that was probably, you know, obvious for our grandfathers or whatever, but now you have to work much harder to do it. And so I love being out of reception. I'm sure you do, and a lot of your listeners. And I think that's the first kind of, the first thing is that you're, especially if you're trout fishing or steelhead fishing, you're in a beautiful place outside, hopefully for the whole day. And to me, I always tell people, like, the fishing starts the day of it, and even the day before when you're looking forward to it. It isn't just being on the water, and it isn't just catching that fish. It's like, if I'm with a friend, especially someone who's starting, I'm like, I'm so happy to be with you. I'm so happy to be outside here, and we're going to screw up, and we're going to catch a tree or get knots, but that's okay. This whole thing is part of it, and we're going to have a beer at lunch, and we're going to hopefully, you know, do well. But once you give yourself over to that rhythm, is a really wonderful thing. And I think, of course, when you're starting, you're so caught up in, am I doing this correctly? And the cast is hard. And you want people ideally to get beyond that, where they're not going crazy with the, you know, 10 to 2 o'clock. And that takes time. And that's probably the second thing I would say about why it's great to get into it, is like, it's a skill and it is hard. And so you do, but you see yourself making these improvements. And when that happens, I think that's meaningful, even as an adult, not just for kids. And then when you make a cast that you're proud of, or you're starting to get that mend in there, or you know, if you're on the flats and you see a bonefish on your own, that's a really big deal the first time that happens. And when you kind of, you have these things that you've been struggling to do and you overcome them, it's probably like if you're cooking and you like make a good souffle or whatever, not that I can do that, but when that happens, yeah, you're like, oh my God, I made this food, or I caught this fish. And that's a nice thing. And I think there's so many things in our life, we're moving so quickly, that to take the time to kind of develop a skill. And I think people want that in their lives more and more, or that they realize it's missing in their lives. They're online a lot. And so when you're fishing, you're kind of entering this world of, it's a wonderful world, and it never ends, even for those of us who do it a lot. Then we try to go salmon fishing, and we're trying to learn how to double hand cast, or we're trying to catch a permit, or doing something truly insane. And so you keep setting yourself up to learn new things, and of course, failing along the way. And I should really reiterate in all the things I write about, I am not a guide, and I am not like a super pro. Like I make a fool of myself on a regular basis. And I think, and maybe that's the third thing, if you're asking about getting into it, it's like, you've got the, what we understand sort of success to be fishing. Of course, you want to catch a fish, but it's very humbling. And, you know, it takes, I think, you know, we're watching maybe videos online and you think all you're going to do is catch a fish. I'm like, spoiler alert, you're not. it's a lot more about not catching them. And then, but that, it kind of gives it the symmetry of the sport, that then when you do catch a fish, like the 7 hours of waiting, or the hopefully not that long, but like you, it brings some perspective to it. And I think to give yourself over to that, there's not instant gratification. You can't buy your way into success. It takes time. And that slows us down in a way that I think is great. And then when you finally do hopefully catch that Atlantic salmon or steelhead, if you're really brutal on yourself, then it all that waiting has more meaning. And I think that to put ourselves in that position is a great thing.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, you're bringing up all these memories and kind of emotions because it's, you know, the steelhead or any of these things. I mean, I've had lots of moments where, you know, it's that moment you get that fish in and you know, maybe you get a picture, maybe you don't, but it's just more about, yeah, you're like, wow, I did this thing. And
yeah,
this is an amazing spot. And there's maybe a 1 in a million chance maybe that happened. Yeah. Right. You know, sounds like you feel that a lot. That's kind of what you understand about it.
Well, I think, yes. I mean, I think as the more you fish, then you kind of set these new bars of difficulty for yourself. It doesn't mean I still like to fish in a very, like, kind of the Catskills is sort of my home water. And I don't need to catch the biggest fish there. I like to be outside. I like it when the seasons change. But every now and then, I like to do something crazy. And I'm like, all right, I'm starting to get into Atlantic salmon fishing. And this, the fact that it's sort of unhinged and irrational, like, that appeals to me. That's definitely not for everyone. And I'm sure you've got friends who, they want to catch fish and then we try to do a certain thing together. And I have other friends usually who fish for a lot. They're like, they want to do it a certain way, just on a dry fly or in a certain place. And I'm sure you do too. You talk to so many people who fish and some are like, I want to get up at 4 and crush them and this. Or other people like, you know what? I want to catch a beautiful, you know, brook trout on a dry fly in a place that where I fish with my grandfather or whatever. And that's, I love that. You know, it's like a way you get to know somebody.
That's perfect. No, you've got me thinking about it. We just had a podcast, with Oliver White, and he was telling the story about Jimmy Kimmel, you know, and Jim, you know, they have the South Fork Lodge.
Of course.
He was saying, I asked him about Jimmy. I was like, so tell me what's he like, you know, or as far as this fishing, is he, like you're saying, is he totally into it? Does he do everything? And he said, well, actually Huey Lewis is more of the dry fly fanatic. And he was talking about Huey's this, that's all he does is
Love
dry
it.
Flies, right? All the time. It's just dry flies. And he gives Jimmy a hard time sometimes, like saying, hey, you should, right? But that's kind of what you're talking about, right? These,
yeah,
no matter who you are, Huey Lewis, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, you, me, it's the same thing. We find these little things we love, we kind of really get into, but we have our own thing, right? And you can change that and evolve over time.
I totally agree. And I love that. And I think there's this, I mean, people who fly fish are already in a, you know, it's not the easiest way to catch a fish, right? So you're already making some decision about how you sort of like driving a manual transmission, or if you like to play squash or something. It's like, it's not the obvious thing to do. So you're already a little bit unique in a way. And then from there, I have friends just like you who will only fish dry flies. And I have other friends who are like, I'll catch a fish with a woolly bugger and I really don't care. And sometimes as you get older, you kind of can track your own progress in the way that you like to fish, or you say like, you know, I can fish an hour on a dry and then nothing happens. We're putting on a nymph. Okay. Like, let's be real.
Right.
And that's like, when you know that about yourself, it's, you know, that's a good thing or a funny thing. And the sport allows so much variation. And I think I've been lucky enough now to meet a lot of people and fish with a lot of people. And I think probably I had a certain more regimented way of doing things, but as you meet more people, I mean, you understand that there's room for everybody in that. And if someone is like, we're using a dry dropper, or this person has never been on a drift boat before, we want to have some action. And you're like, of course, like they're catching, how could you ever, you know, turn your nose up at someone catching, you know, their first day on, you know, on the Yellowstone or whatever it is. You want them to have a good memory. And then they'll have their own kind of progression and their own education and their own way that they arrive at being completely crazy on, you know, 7X with the blue wing olive 22 and let them figure it out.
Yeah, that's awesome. No, and we've been doing some of our school trip, you know, schools around the country. And so we're heading out to these places. It's kind of cool because sometimes people are brand new to it. Sometimes they have more experience, but we're heading out to Virginia to fish with the Mossy Creek Fly Shop guys. And I've never been to the Shenandoahs and
fun.
It's, you know, brook trout, right? But it's totally different. So it's not like we're going to chase giant whatever. You know, these are tiny little brook trout up in the streams. They have rainbows and browns too, we're going to be hitting. But I just think about that, like, that's pretty cool. I've never fished it. So for me, it's more about going to a new place. Do you find, you know, for you, that's like half of it, just checking out these new places and not even the fishing? That's not even like maybe the highest priority all the time?
I think that's a great point. I love, you know, to go somewhere new and to understand, you know, the ecosystem is such a great pleasure, especially if you're lucky enough to be with someone from that area. And so if you go to, you know, the Smoky Mountains or Shenandoah, and you catch a trout that's like true to that place And it might be 8 inches. And I think there's a time where you get caught up, or it's natural that, you know, you want a big fish or you want a bigger fish. And then you maybe are lucky enough to catch a few of those. And then you're like, you know, this fish feels correct to the place. And if you're really having a great day, you're like, maybe you drink the beer from that place, or you're with, or you see how the people fish and there's a special fly, or, you know, you stop at the shop in that area and you kind of understand an area and the watershed. And that's a great thing. And I love to do that. And, you know, I also like to go back to, I think you want kind of, my book is about travel in a lot of ways and some of these really special places, but it's also about kind of your home water and how you have this relationship to a place over time, and you get to know the seasons and you have memories there and you remember who you fished with in those places. And I think fishing can be one of those great things that helps you measure time. And if you fish with, I mean, it's often you fish with your father or your son or your mother, your family members from different generations, or just old guys who taught me how to fish. And then, you know, they move on and pass away, and then you're the one teaching other people. And that's kind of, you never sort of thought that someone would be looking to you to land a fish. And you're like, oh, wait, I'm the one helping someone else. And that kind of puts things in perspective and you feel a little older than you expected. But that, like, the way of sharing the sport is, and having it be shared with you and then you can share with other people is a great thing. And I really like doing that more than I ever thought. So if I go to a new place, or if I take someone to a place that matters to me, I don't even fish really in the Catskills when I have a new person there, and I kind of guide them a little bit. And also, like, you can be patient in ways you maybe didn't expect. And you just tell your friends, everyone's made these mistakes before. Don't sweat it. You know, like, whatever, there's no mistake you can make that I haven't made myself.
And when you're doing that, you're kind of guiding, right? But yeah, you're not, sure. Do you feel like, I mean, I guess for me, I always felt like when I do that, when I was guiding, there was a lot of pressure.
Yes.
You know, do you, like, I guess I'm assuming that you don't feel that pressure when you're just hanging out, or do you feel like that's something you need to get them into some fish?
I think it's easy to forget how, like, nervous you are when you're starting, because maybe you catch a tree behind you, or you think you're going to screw up, or you, like, set too fast. So the first thing I try to do is just, like, have people relax. Like, I mean, I want to relax myself, but I think everyone will have more fun if they're not so revved up. You know, it's like they've had 4 espressos or something, the equivalent of that. And they're just like, oh my God, we're going out, or how's it, what's going to happen? Or they've got new waiters, or they don't. I'm like, let's just enjoy ourselves. Like, look at where we are. If you were sitting in the city a week ago, you would die to be out in the Catskills on the beautiful stream. And in a week when you're back cranking out work and strut, you'd be like, oh God, I'd love to be in the Catskills. I don't care if I catch nothing. So I'm like, well, let's think about it like that. And if we catch something, it's great. I'm happy to be with you. This is a great place. And then you try to, like, have people slow down a little bit, and they'll, you know, they'll be into fish. They'll see what's at stake. And hopefully, you know, you catch something and they have a great, you know, great memory, but then it's also something that they can build on. And I think everyone sort of looks back and is like, I can't believe I cared that much about that fish. Now I've caught many more. And you're like, yeah, but of course that's what happens when you're starting out, you know? And I try to keep everybody calm. I mean, it's, as a true guide where people are paying, that's going to be a very different equation. And then people are going to have expectations. And it's a little bit unfortunate, because fishing is hard enough that once money enters into it and you're going on a trip and, oh my God, I paid this and the guide should be doing that. And it's like, that's not really fair. Every guide wants you to catch fish. We're all in this together. You know, if you get blown out, I was just bone fishing and we had a couple of tough days. And, you know, that's like, whose fault? That's nobody's fault. That's just a higher power, man. You know?
Dreaming of battling a giant rainbow trout in Alaska's untouched rivers? Turn that dream into a reality with Fishhound Expeditions. Immerse yourself in the heart of Alaska, where epic landscapes and legendary fish await. Visit fishhoundexpeditions.com and mention this podcast to begin your adventure. Fishhound Expeditions, your gateway to the ultimate Alaskan fishing experience. Trout Routes is the most comprehensive mapping app for trout anglers. With over 50,000 trout streams, 350,000 access points, public land maps, and more, Trout Routes is the number one resource for navigating, researching, and exploring trout streams. You can download Trout Routes for free in the App Store today. Just search for Trout Routes on your phone and take your exploration to the next level. That's Trout Routes, TrouteRoutes. I've been around the last, doing these trips that we've been doing, some really great guides. And, you know, I feel like that's one of the biggest things, that, you know, just having the guide up front, you know, ask the person, like, hey, what are your goals? you know, what do you want? Let's make sure we're checking the stuff off the list, you know? And so I find that's something that's really awesome. And I'm sure we're going to be doing that in Virginia, and we're, you know, doing a driftless thing. We're kind of doing some trout, a lot of trout stuff around, but,
sweet.
But yeah, it's going to be good. So well, let's talk a little bit on the Believer, maybe just, highlight a few of the places you went to, and we could talk about that a little bit. Maybe first, where did this book, you know, idea, I think you might have mentioned it on the last one, but take us back. How did this idea come to be that now it's a published book?
To have The Optimist, my last book out in the world, was sort of a step because, like I said, you know, I'm not Tom Rosenbauer. I'm not giving people technical advice. I'm just someone who loves to fish, and I love to write, and I love to travel, and I try to kind of communicate sort of what's at stake as a kind of enthusiastic amateur. And then I was thinking, you know, my COVID sort of changed everybody's timeline and your relationship to what you want to do with your life. And my girlfriend moved in with me, and it, you know, you don't know how much longer you're going to have to take these trips, or how much is fishing going to be a priority of your life when you have other things going on in a shared life. And so I sort of thought, I have this year where I can try to do a lot before other things happen and, you know, in our domestic situation. And so I was like, where can I go? Where have I always wanted to go? And what can I write about? And so at first I had these idea of these big pilgrimages. And then that, like I mentioned, because of the pandemic, some of those sort of fell through. So I still was like, well, where have I always wanted to go? I mean, I love Patagonia. It's one of the great places. So I went to Patagonia. I went to Cuba, where I always wanted to go. I went to Belize to try to catch a permit, which is totally insane behavior. And then I got kind of caught up in Atlantic salmon fishing. I went to Norway to learn from this sort of Swedish expert. It was absolutely a disaster. And so then I got kind of a salmon emergency. So I went to Scotland to try to sort that out. And then I did some road trips around America. So it was a lot. And then my usual fishing. And so I was trying to kind of write as I went. And I mean, to me, what you're saying about going to a new place, like to go to Scotland, you know, you see these, like, these are famous rivers with famous beats on them and sort of old hotels where people go and drink in the pubs, and their gillies and a whole group of traditions. And, you know, the gear is different and the reels are different, lines are different and the flies are different. I'm like, oh my God, I have nothing. This is like starting over, and like the cast is different, and I'm making mistakes that I thought, they're like, don't muscle it. I was like, oh my God, I never thought I was going to muscle a cast again, but because it's like a two-handed cast and I think I got across, you know, cast 85 feet that I need to. So, I mean, I love Scotland and I love salmon fishing. I don't need to catch a lot of fish, so I don't mind like getting, you know, but I'm guessing you, if you're a steelhead fisherman, probably the same way.
Yeah.
But that was really exciting for me. And I love the flats too. I fish in the Bahamas a lot. And I, to my surprise, I don't know if it's because of living in New York where we're, you know, surrounded by tall buildings, but like to go to the flats where there's nothing around, is very, you know, as horizontal as it gets. I love that. And wading, where I go, we wade on kind of sandy bottom flats. It's absolutely gorgeous. And the fishing is good, but even when you're not catching fish, just being out there is sort of a kind of a, changes your equilibrium in a way that I really, really like.
Wow.
The big answer there. Sorry.
No, it's good. I'm just looking at these places, you know, again, Patagonia, Cuba, Belize. I mean, they're all, you know, and Atlantic salmon as well, but maybe I want to touch on the Belize thing, because we are heading actually to Belize down to the Blue Horizon Lodge. And but talk about that. What was the most challenging thing in Belize? What was your biggest surprise when you went down there?
Well, I think that the hard part about permit fishing is you tell yourself you're not, like I mentioned, I've done a lot of bonefish fishing, and I was like, well, it's similar principles, you know, you look for the tail, you're casting a crab instead of a gotcha or whatever. And I was like, this can't be that, like, the premise is pretty much the same. But somehow, when it's a permit and you see that tail, you, like, I just, like, was totally melted and lost. Yeah, freak out, buck fever. And the guides, some guides are really intense, some are really mellow. And I think it's like, do you really want to get yourself involved with a permit? Just because once you start, then you're like, you tell yourself, oh, I just want to see one. I just want to see one. And then you're like, okay. But once you see it, then you want to cast to it. I mean, of course you do. And then you're like, well, once I cast it, I'd like to kind of feel it on the line. And then once you feel it on the line, you want to fight it. And once you fight it, you want to land it. And so you're just like absolutely reduced to a mess in a way. And that, and I mean, I love Belize. I think it's a really, really great place. And we fish for baby tarpon, which I absolutely love. I think it's a great, great sport. And I think people should not overlook baby tarpon. A 10 or 15 or 20 pound tarpon is absolutely fantastic on a fly line. You fight them fast, super visual. And then knowing you have an hour when you're going to be on a flat where there might be permit is, you know, that's a great day. But you gotta be honest with yourself and not like beat yourself up if you're gonna. I know plenty of people, serious anglers who've never caught their permit, and that's not because they're not great. It didn't align or who knows what. I mean, it's like you can beat yourself up over that, but you kind of want to be realistic about what you're getting into. But then if it works out, you know, you're feeling pretty lucky.
That's it. Yeah, if it works out, it's kind of good. And did it work out for you?
Far be it from me to give it away, but I should just say I had a whole range of emotions. I was in a very dark place, and a permit broke my hook at the eye, which I didn't like. I'd never done that before, and so I was like, I just sat there with the guide, like, and the boat was just floating, and I was like, I don't know, like, what do you do after that? I mean, there's nothing he can say. There's nothing you can do. You're just staring at this thing and you're like, you've got to be kidding me. And you're like in this beautiful place. And I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, it's good. I like that. I like that. I've had some of those moments. I go back to steelhead a lot just because that's the species that I've caught a lot of. But you have those moments where you kind of want to get in to see it. And some of that there is places where you could harvest fish too. So you're like, okay, I want to get this giant fish in to have food for my family. You know, sort of thing, like some real, like that sort of stuff. And then sometimes that fish slips away and it pops off the hook right at the last minute. And then you see it swim away slowly and you're like, oh my God. But then sometimes, like we said, it's the opposite. So this is cool. So that was Belize, we've got a good story there. Talk about the Atlantic salmon, touch on that a little bit, because that is one of those species. It sounds like you had some crazy stories that, again, it's one of those really tough ones. It's not easy to, the casting, the rods. And I'm assuming you guys were using like huge two-handed rods, single spay.
Yep, 14 foot kind of eight weight or 13 and a half foot eight weight rods. And I went to this sort of salmon camp in northern Norway, and I absolutely love Norway. I love the, like, there are these wonderful wooden hotels, kind of like farms where you stay, inns that have been there for hundreds of years, and it is gorgeous countryside and just really wonderful place. And I get to this kind of house where this Swedish man drives across the border from Sweden, and he's like a very, very accomplished angler, like been at it for decades and really sort of famous character. And he teaches people how to cast and fish. And everyone else had canceled because it was still sort of the end of the pandemic. And so it was just me. I was his only student. And this guy destroyed me. Like, he didn't like the rod I had or the lines I had. And so he's teaching me to cast every day. And like, I was like totally broken down, and he's like teaching me his technique. And then I would go out fishing every, you know, in the afternoon and then the evening, and in these huge rivers. And in Norway, they're absolutely immense. But this guy, his big theory was like, he wanted you to catch a fish on your own. Only then did it really count. And I was like, can you help me a little bit? So I went there. There were no fish in the river. We saw a few fish jump, but there weren't as many as there should be, but which didn't matter anyway, because I was getting it absolutely handed to me. And I would go every day. And I was like, you know, it's not just about this fish. I mean, I was trying to be enlightened about it and say, it's, you know, it's this journey, or you're learning something, or you're having this experience. Then you're like, wait a minute, I'm going to be in Norway for 10 days. I'm away from my girlfriend. She would have loved to be here. I'm alone in this ridiculous house drinking, you know, aquavit, for God's sake, like a college student. And I'm like not catching any fish and like not really getting close either. It's not like trout weight. And so that was like a learning experience, partly because it exposed like what I was telling myself, that, you know, I tried to pretend I'm outside this like transactional part of the sport. And every now and then, I think probably with very hard fish like permit and Atlantic salmon, you may tell yourself one thing before you fish. And then afterward, you find out that it did matter to your vanity that you caught one, or you want to be a person who succeeds. And sometimes that's a tough one. And I'll tell you, it was a long flight back, long flight back from Stockholm.
No kidding.
Yeah. And, no kidding. You know, and then it's like, you know, that's part of your, I think if you wait long enough at all the, you know, when your football team loses in the playoffs and the day after you're like, I'm done with sports.
Right.
And then of course, like the next season comes and you're ready to, in my case, watch the Minnesota Vikings. And obviously we lose all the time. So every time my friends are like, we're done, no more of this, stop the pain. And then next year you're like, oh, we'll be back. And it's the same thing with salmon or steelhead. I mean, it's like, I didn't quite the first time, and this isn't in the book, but the first time I went out to British Columbia, the only time, and I was like, oh, I see what's going on. Like, I see why these guys are, like, I see the appeal, you know, in a huge way. And I can also see why, like, people start getting there's an intensity that comes from that.
For Steelhead, like Steelhead Trip?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, like my trip, the Skeena was blown out and we only could do it a couple of days. I mean, and then I was like, this is truly insane. And I naturally enjoyed that very much.
What did you guys fish on the, what rivers did you fish?
Well, we fished the Skeena one day. Most of the days it was blown out. And then we went for kind of other salmon because we went, there were no place we could fish. And then finally, on the last day, I was with some fancy guys. So we, and I'm sure this would upset a lot. We're in a helicopter and we went to the Copper River.
Oh, yeah.
And naturally we couldn't, like the fish were as far on the other side as possible and we couldn't get our cast there. And I luckily did catch a steelhead and it was freaking fantastic. It was a classic thing. I got one, my friend's videoing it and I'm like, put that camera away. This is bad luck. I don't know. And then as soon as I landed, I'm like, could you please send me that video? I want to watch.
That's right.
Like, you don't want footage when you lose it, but when you have, and you're as soon as it's in the net, then you're like, want to watch yourself probably.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, we've been doing some trips with Brian Niska at the Skeena Bay Lodge.
And oh, sweet.
They've set up the helicopter thing. They're doing like an interesting crossover this winter. So they've got some skiing, which is like 10 minutes away. But they've got these heli trips they're doing. So it's kind of interesting. But yeah, I know that area really well. It's pretty amazing. But it is tough. Steelhead numbers have been going down. So it's a tough place right now.
Yeah, I mean that, you know, there's no way around salmon and steel. I mean, all the watersheds everywhere are not in good shape, but for salmon and steelhead, that's no joke. And it's and sad on every level possible.
Yeah. Do you, in your, you know, kind of out there writing, I mean, conservation is always a big thing for, you know, I think all of us, because we realize, right, it's the most important thing. But do you think about that? Do you write about that? Do you talk about that a lot?
Yeah. I mean, I think you got to think about it. Sometimes I'm always fascinated to talk to guides, you know, people who really know a certain place, like what's changed over the years. And it's, none of it's good. I mean, I'm all very fascinated in Bonefish Tarpon Trust, who do a lot of good work, and Atlantic Salmon Federation and other organizations, and, you know, just following all these things that you ignore it at your own risk, or you think someone else is going to solve it at your own risk. We've got to be the ones, people who love to fish and love the water, have to be the ones who like are involved and give money or try to put attention on these causes and not shy away from it because it seems overwhelming or depressing, even though it is overwhelming and often depressing. But you know, it's like when the striped bass come in New York, like every year it's sooner, which means like because the water is warmer that they come up, pass up in the spring. And then in the fall and winter, every year it's later that they go back down to the Chesapeake because the water's warm. So, you know, there's no hiding from it. And I think, you know, we've got to be the ones, especially, you know, people who have an audience and access, people who have podcasts and who are writing about these things have to, you know, communicate what's at stake and that the changes are real. And anyone who's on the water any amount of time will confirm that.
Yeah, that's it. And yeah, I mean, I look at the numbers, you know, and we find sometimes, you know, the conservation episodes we do are a little bit lower listened to, but we do hear from our listeners and I ask them, what do they want to hear? And people do want to hear more of those episodes, you know, so I think it's something, obviously it's important, but yeah. And you said the Bonefish Tarpon Trust, we're going to be talking to them as well as we do this Belize trip.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's an important point.
I mean, and I also think that sometimes you go somewhere on the other side of the world and you fall in love with it, but also it's good to love what's closest to you, whether it's the cats, in my case, the Catskills, and you want to be involved with something that you feel like you have something to do with, whether it's Trout Unlimited or whatever is local. And you know, you want to be engaged. I think that's just part of the responsibility we all have. And I think we should try to stay strong and active and do the best we can. And that's probably all we can hope for.
Right. That's it. Well, you know, going back to the book here, I mean, I was thinking about this just as far as your audience, when you get into these things, are you thinking about who is going to be reading this thing? You know, I mean, I'm guessing it's kind of because of your background fairly general, but do you know who those people are? Or are you looking to kind of target a certain segment?
Dave, it's a huge issue about like people who know what 6X is and,
yeah, right.
You know, and a Parachute Adams and people totally. Who don't. And I think, you know, I write I just wrote something for the Atlantic Salmon Journal, which was pretty exciting. And I try to be clear about who I am and what I'm doing and that I'm not like a technical expert telling the most brilliant, I'm not developing flies or techniques. I'm trying to communicate what places like what, you know, what does it actually feel like to be in Belize or Patagonia? What are the guides like? How do they, what are you eating? What are the boats like? What's the landscape? And then kind of what's at stake with the fishing? Like what's hard about it or easy? What the challenges are, and how kind of emotionally you get caught up in what it means to go in very skinny water to cast to a very wary trout, like in the Truffle River, where you get one chance at a fish a day in the most beautiful river ever. And you're like, and you try to explain, like, what does the wind sound like? And I think if you can communicate that and bring people there, and that you can hear only the wind in your heart pounding or whatever it is, and you've got one chance to make a fish or to cast, and what does it mean to spook a fish? And of course, most people know, but some people, you want to put them in that place. And if they feel, I think most readers, if they feel what you're feeling, the excitement and the nerves and all the, and hopefully the triumph, but often the humiliation, if you put them there, then I don't think it matters if they've fished for 20 years or if they're new. And you have to trust, and like my editors and the first people who read the book are not anglers, so they're good people to judge that. And I try to give enough details for people who particularly care, but also try to have this more universal, you know, why we feel good when something happens, or why if you land a 22-inch trout on a 6X, like why that matters or why it's hard. And you may not say, oh, you don't want to get, well, this is what the, you know, stress poundage is. You just right. say like, well, you've got, you can only do it this fast. And if the fish turns away, or why you're nervous to finally try to raise the rod at the last moment. And if you can communicate that, I mean, I'm not saying I've mastered it by any means, but you try, I focus on those things that I hope people can understand, even if they haven't, you know, been to Patagonia every year for a decade, like some insane friends of mine.
Yeah. You can always find somebody, you know, no matter what, that's always going to be at a higher level than you, no matter what it is, right? And this is interesting because it sounds like you're talking about their, you know, it is a fairly general audience, although like you're speaking to this audience now, which are pretty a mix, but they're all coming, everybody's here for fly fishing. And, but you are speaking to just the whole experience of travel and getting out there and the experience. And it's not just about the 6X tippet. So, and that's something where somebody like, you know, we had an episode with Echo and Tim Rajeff, and he talked about the casting, right? He broke down sure. the tips, and he talked about how when you snap, you know, when you go back and you do your back cast and you hear that snap, you know, you're going too fast.
Yeah, exactly.
He said that's the speed of sound, basically, or whatever, however he said it, right? He described this really technically because it's Tim. But I mean, sometimes it's good to get in that, but I think sometimes it's good just to be on the surface, like you're talking about, like, hey, this is not about technical dry fly fishing. This is about the experience of what it feels like. And you can educate somebody listening right now, like, what does it feel like to go to fish for Atlantic salmon in Norway?
Yeah, I think hopefully there's this balance where there's something where you say, you know, there are abstract terms like a 20 mile an hour wind in your face, you know, like, what does that mean? Or what is it? Or how is it?
Yeah. How do you describe that?
I would basically say it's like, first thing is that it's loud and it's sort of soul destroying. And then you make this cast that you think is good. And then it just sort of ends up crumpling in a heap after you briefly mistook it for being solid. And then you kind of feel like a kid, but then fishing being the way it is, you can't just try harder. I think men often believe, oh, I'll just muscle it or do it harder. I'm like, not in fly fishing generally, which is, you know, you can't just yank or pull, or there's no direct solution. And I think there's something ultimately, like, this fishing stories generally engage other anglers, right? Because we want to hear, like, if someone comes back from, you know, Belize, or they went, you know, I don't know, sea run trout fishing. I've never been to Tierra del Fuego, but like, bring it on. I want to hear it. If you triumph, I want to hear that. If you got, you know, if it was a soul destroying moment, I want to hear that too. I love sad fishing stories. I love happy ones. And I think anglers like that, like mostly people, even people who fished a lot, they generally, who've read my books, they'll like come up to me and be like, oh my God, I know that guide, or I know that feeling, or the same thing happened to me. Or like, there's something that we all share. And that's why if you meet someone who fishes at a party and you kind of go off to the side and you're like, oh, you know, you have a lot in common, even people who are like truly at an elite level, they still, you know, they connect with you. And people who are just getting into it, you know, I have friends who I can tell are like on websites buying gear at, you know, at midnight and sending me things. Should I get this? And I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, because they're starting to get into it. And I think that's great, too.
It's time to talk about something that elevates your fishing experience. Stonefly Nets, nestled in the heart of the Ozarks, Ethan, a master craftsman, dedicates his skill to creating the finest wood landing nets. They aren't just tools, they are works of art blending tradition and craftsmanship. You know, every time I set my stonefly net in the water, it's not just the fish that catches my eye, it's the beauty of the net itself. These nets are tailored to your fishing style with options to customize the size, handle, and even the intricate wood burls. They are a perfect mix of functionality and aesthetic appeal. And let's talk about the memories. Just like Ethan, many of us cherish fly fishing as a way to connect with our past and creating lasting memories. Stonefly nets are more than just nets. They are part of our story, each cast and every cast. Are you ready to make fishing trips unforgettable? Visit stoneflynets.com right now and discover the difference a handcrafted net can make. Picture this. You're casting your line into the pristine waters of the Togiak River, surrounded by untouched Alaskan wilderness. At Togiak River Lodge, the dream becomes a reality. Here, every cast brings a chance of a lifetime, battling salmon or reeling in that majestic rainbow trout. But it's not just the fish, it's the adventure. With Togiak's expert guides and exclusive access to over 30 miles of river, your fishing story is waiting to be written. And guess what? I'll be joining this summer too. Don't let this be the one that got away. Visit TogiakLodge.com right now. That's Togiak, T-O-G-I-A-K, Lodge, right now, and embark on your unforgettable journey. Remember, it's not just fishing, it's Togiak. When you were on Tom Rosenbauer on the podcast, what did you guys, do you remember what you talked about on that one?
Well, I've fished with Tom a few times, and I, which I consider to be like very lucky to do so. And I think he's an amazing, he's a really important figure in the sport. And I love that he's, 20 years ago, he wouldn't have been like, I'm going to host a podcast every week. I mean, are you kidding me? Like these things, just like you weren't thinking about that. And I love how he's evolved. And he's a brilliant angler. And he doesn't, like a lot of really great anglers, he doesn't draw attention to himself right away. He doesn't try to do the hardest thing. And I'm sure he's used to everyone who fishes with him being like, oh my God, I'm fishing with Tom Rosenbauer. He's a legend. And he isn't like, watch this cast. It's the hardest right. thing. Like, he's like, right. he just does the simplest thing. He casts very close to himself. And I was like, this is great. And, you know, he gives me a hard time. So when I was on his podcast, like I wear like, you know, barber jacket or kind of more traditional clothes when I go fishing. And this is some of the stuff I look for on eBay late at night. And Tom was like, sort of joking that the first time I met, we went fishing together in absolutely miserable weather on Martha's Vineyard trying to catch false albacore, that I was overdressed, and he sort of remembered that, but he was giving me a hard time about that. And we talked about like fishing close to home and how that is a great thing. And I've learned from him, I've thought about that a lot since then, and listening to him on his podcast about, you know, you write about these like heroic journeys, or not heroic, but, you know, dream destinations, and that's really great. And if you're lucky enough to do that, or that's your priority, if you have time or the finances, like, you know, it is, I mean, go to Patagonia. It's one of the great things you can do. But fishing is so much more than that. And I don't think people should be discouraged. I think it's important to fish close to where you live. And if you're getting into the sport, and, you know, and it's like, I'm from Minnesota. I went smallmouth bass fishing in Wisconsin. I love that. I mean, it doesn't have, or if you've got very small brook trout, if you're in Virginia or North Carolina, like there's nothing, like there's not a hierarchy there in a way that people like, oh, the fish is under a foot, 12 inches. It doesn't kind of like get out there and have, and I mean, from Tom, I've learned, and I think I can appreciate like what it means to like fish near where you live, and getting to understand a certain body of water is a really wonderful thing. And even maybe writing it down like, oh, I caught the first fish of the year on April 7th or whatever. You always think you're good. I keep a fishing diary now, just very simple. It's not like a novel or anything. I just like who I was fishing with, what day. And oh my God, it snowed that week. And we were crazy enough to fish anyway. And we got our, you know, only got one thing on the first cast and nothing after that. And because you're going to forget this stuff. And also it's nice to look back and be reminded of who you were with and what you did. And you also can learn quite a lot too. So I would 100% recommend to anybody, get a little notebook and just write down what you did, and don't, and you'll start to add other details of like what flies you used, or something funny someone said, or if someone brought a great bottle of bourbon, and you, it's just nice to look back on that. I mean, I even look back 6 months ago and I'm like, I totally forgot that happened.
Right.
Or, you know, what guide we were with. And it's a really nice, it gives you a sense of the continuity of the sport, which is another wonderful part about it.
Love it. Yeah, no, I think the journal is an awesome tip. That's always a reminder, and I don't do a good job of that. I'm going to start listening to you now. I'm going to start doing this on our trips this
year.
I think it is a cool, and maybe, who knows, maybe you'll see me writing more this year. That's something I've never prided myself on, you know, on being a great writer. It's, what would you say to that? Do you think writing is like anything? You just, if you do it enough, you slowly get better and better.
Well, I think writing is hard because people want to sound smart. And the first thing I would tell someone is don't try to sound smart. And on the simplest thing about the diary, people don't do it because they think they've got to write too much. I would say for that, just start writing a list, like literally say what the date is and don't make it hard on yourself. It's much easier when you're just like October 15th, whatever, the Madison River, swinging soft tackle flies. It was snowed overnight, warmed up in the afternoon, caught a 16 incher, lost a 20 incher, whatever. And just like straight up that 8 year and like just write down lists and then it will make more sense. For people who are like really trying to write, I was like, try to sound like yourself. Don't try to sound super smart. Like, and don't, I think when you're like in high school or something and you're like, ooh, I'm gonna try to get an A on this paper and I'm gonna use these words. It's like that's, but people still do it. They're 30 or 40. Like, this is craziness. It's like,
yeah.
I mean, some people, if you write whatever, 10,000 hours worth of writing, you're gonna develop something. But plenty of people, especially people who are expert, like someone who writes a cookbook, someone who writes about fishing from a technical point of view, they don't have to be brilliant stylists writing wise. They just need to be clear and sound like themselves. I mean, one interesting thing, Tom has been interviewing more writers. He interviewed Tom McGuane. He interviewed, I think, John Garak. I'm not sure. He interviewed John McPhee, which was incredible. And I mean, and these are professional people who, I mean, John McPhee is one of the great writers. Tom, yep. McGuane, you just don't try to do that for anyone else. I mean, that's like, those guys are truly brilliant. But I think for the rest of us, it's a good habit to get into and don't try to make it, just try to be natural and keep doing it and communicate clearly. And if it seems like trying to make it sound, I edit a lot of people's work and I think people who aren't professional writers can tell really, really good stories about all sorts of things. They can talk about, I don't know, whatever, their birthday party when they were 10 or a disastrous prom when they were 17. But it's like, just keep it simple and sound like yourself. And then that would be my little writing. Yep, exactly.
Love it. What do you think? This is kind of random, but I've been thinking a lot about this, but like the whole AI thing, you know, out there, the ChatGPT, where you can literally put it, I mean, we could take the entire transcript from this episode right now, throw it into ChatGPT and start talking to it and say, hey, give me a 1,000-word blog post on this, right? I mean, that's the stuff that's going on. Do you even think about that stuff at all and how that changes and evolves like the industry you're in?
I do think about it. I mean, it's just part of the world we live in, and it's both fascinating and frightening to me. And I know people who feel it encroaching on their industry, and I think that's something that's going to evolve. In a very selfish way, for me, I have a kind of specific way of writing and tone that it's sort of hard to imitate, and that doesn't mean it's good. It partly means it's unhinged or has my own very specific obsessions. And I think it could probably be, there could be a spoof made about it or a satirized in some way. But I don't, you know, I've got to just do what I can do. I mean, like.
And you can't copy it, right? You can't. I mean, that's the thing about you see this online sometimes when you see you'll do a Google search and something will come up and it'll be obviously somebody just copied a ChatGPT, you know, an AI and put it into a blog post. And it's like, whoa, that is terrible. So, I mean, I think still the tech is not there. You have to do a lot of work on that stuff. So I think it is obvious. But I mean, there's no way they're going to replace. I mean, but maybe, who knows, right? Maybe down the line there it gets better and it does get to a point where it could literally copy exactly your style, your everything.
Well, then I have some issues. I mean, I've got a newsletter. I write a dispatch every week. I write for a bunch of other places, and we'll see if they can keep up. We'll have to, and if they can, imitate our voices and replace us on the podcast too. But I think, you know, you want to be wide ranging and you want to be human. And I think at some, you know, like when you're talking about like writing about fishing, most fishing stories end like in two ways. You know, you either catch it or you don't. And there's sort of familiar ways to do this. Maybe you like struggle and then you succeed, or you think you're going to succeed and then you fail spectacularly. And I tried in my book to like not just fall into those two kind of cadences. And there is you want some payoff. I love to read about people fighting fish or struggling. I like action. But you also want some sort of human side to it. And I think if you do that, hopefully a lot of people will come along for the ride.
Yeah, I think so. What about, we haven't talked about this yet. We talked about it quite a bit on the last episode, the style, you know, and all that. Are you still kind of involved fully in kind of that whole writing? And is that still a real focus for you? And maybe talk about that. You know, we talked about in the last episode, but what does that style mean to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, my first book is called Men in Style, and I'm very interested in kind of traditional clothes and tailored clothing, probably not in suits and all sorts of things that probably not a lot of people still wear. And I do some partnerships with companies where a lot of cool things that you just can't get anymore. So I think I did a kind of a 1970s style sunglasses, but that had polarized lenses that came out when The Optimist did. And that was kind of a cool thing. They were like made by hand in England. And that was a fun project to do. And I'm, you know, can't ever find the right shirts that I want that have like big pockets, just in kind of a khaki the way Filson used to make. And so I'm out looking for those on eBay late at night too. And I do, I mean, there are a lot of good technical fabrics, but sometimes things are too technical. I don't think we need to go look like we're about to walk on the moon, for goodness sake. And it's just fishing. And sometimes I'll work with, you know, a shoe company. I did a project with Huckberry, and we worked with Rancord, this great shoemaker in Maine, to make a couple of a shoe that was cool. Sometimes I'm looking for something that has like a boat sole, a non-marking sole that can go on a moccasin so you can wear it in a boat or kind of on the water. And I did a whole project with this English company, Drake's, just about clothes that I sort of wish existed, kind of you could wear into a lodge and still sort of like be sort of sporting and sort of elegant. And I love that sort of stuff. And I wish there were more things made that your kind of previous generations would have worn, and everything is so new all the time and it's so exhausting. I understand that's what all these places have to do, but I need one thing that does, you know, that keeps me dry, and then the rest can be a little bit more more traditional.
Yeah, I think, and there are some companies I think that are doing a good job with that. I think, I don't know, it seems like a lot of them get caught up, but I always tend to go back to the Patagonia, even though it's totally different, not what you're saying. But I think that Yvonne's, you know, his style and the way he thinks of it is like, hey, you know, less is more. You know, we sure need to, right, not only think conservation first, but, you know, we don't have to have all these new things coming out all the time. I mean, if somebody wanted to dig into more on your background on kind of some of this and learn about this, where would they go on the style and all that stuff?
Well, my newsletter, The Contender, I write a lot about dressing and how to dress. And a lot of men, you know, this stuff isn't covered so much anymore. I mean, I write for Esquire and places like that, and I've written a lot about tailors. But I think men don't feel like they're getting guidance about kind of what suit to wear if they're going for an interview, or what to wear if they're going to buy a tuxedo. And so people are welcome to subscribe to my newsletter. I write about this a lot. My first book, I've mentioned Men in Style, that had a lot to do about kind of what men learned from their fathers, kind of mistakes they made and how they arrived at their sensibility. And I think some of these things, like I love old Filson clothes and old, you know, army jackets and stuff like that. And I think sometimes those things are still really great. And the history of sporting clothes, like L.L. Bean jackets, like those things have not aged badly at all. They still look fantastic. Not everything needs to be in a technical fabric. Sometimes you just need, you know, a classic barn coat or field jacket or something like that. And so I do like looking for that stuff. And, you know, the history of this is kind of a function that people needed when they were shooting or when they were fishing. And so they're very specific pockets. And I love finding out, like, when, I mean, that's why guys, it's so funny, like different fishing vests over the years or bags that, like a lot of fishing bags were then very useful for cameramen because they were, you know, different dividers allowed them to put their lenses in certain places. And so like English bag company is now, then photographers got obsessed with it, and now they made bags for photographers, and now fisher anglers are getting obsessed with. So I love all that where kind of function and form and design kind of meet together.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm looking at this is the L.L. Bean original field coat since 1920. Oh, I'm not sure if this was, but yeah, they've been doing it a while. And yeah, I mean, they've obviously hunting, fishing, all the stuff.
Sure.
And what you're saying is, yeah, you don't have to have the super Gore-Tex, whatever the new fabric is. I mean, some of this older stuff, even wool. I mean, there's nothing better than wool, really, right? I mean, what is better than that material?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I was lucky enough to go into the archive, the L.L. Bean archive in Freeport, Maine, and because they've kept a lot of the things they've had over the years. And it looked so great. And it was so wonderful to be connected to the history. I mean, the history of, even if you're in the Catskills, like what were the original people, what were the Lee Wolf and those old anglers wearing? It's great to see and to be part of that history. And even if you don't, you know, have to imitate it exactly, it's nice to know that I mean, those guys were really, really smart and industrious. And then you kind of fast forward to the 70s and like the guys fishing in Key West and for tarpon and kind of the first group of guys who went after that. And they didn't even have, you know, they're just wearing cutoff jeans and, you know, they didn't have flats boats or anything. It was a whole different thing. And, you know, it's nice to know that history a little bit and to be part of it in a small way.
Yeah, perfect. Let's take it out here pretty quickly here with our, we talked conservation already, so this is going to be kind of our trip shout out. And we're going to give a shout out to our Driftless school we have coming, which is pretty amazing, that part of the world. We're going to be focusing on kind of dry fly fishing out there. But maybe first on this, give us a story that didn't make the book. Is there anything out there that's kind of something happened? I mean, you couldn't have got everything in. Do you ever think about that? Is there something that happened? You can give us a little shed light on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to decide like how much heartbreak or how much triumph like people can handle, you know? And so I was fishing a lot in Patagonia with a dear friend of mine. We were in a river that called the Majejo, which is a wonderful wading river, wading only. And like my friend is a better caster than I was. And so the guide was like, in the most polite way possible, was like, well, maybe we should let Mark Lee try this cast. And he just said it was better for a right-hander because I'm left-handed, Mark was right-handed. But like, it was obvious that like Mark Lee could get the cast right underneath the bank and I couldn't. And I just started to laugh and I was like, okay, I understand. And later though, that same guide put me onto a fish that I would never have seen and where he was sort of spotting ahead of it. And I had a little dry and a little dropper. And he's like, the fish is chasing the dropper. He's like up on the bank. And I was like, oh my God, stay calm. And luckily enough, this huge, I mean, 24 inch, beautiful brown took this very small nymph. And then we had to fight. I had to fight it in this very intimate pool because it couldn't go up or downstream. And none of that would have happened without the guide. And sometimes you just have to say, thanks for help. You know, you got to like, you think like the more you think, you know, or you feel like you're getting to some level, higher level that you're happy with. And then something very humbling will happen, you know, very soon afterward. Even on the Bahamas last week where I felt like I was seeing fish better. I even saw a fish before the guide who has famously good eyes. And I was like, maybe this is starting to really come together. And then the next day it was sort of cloudy water. I saw nothing. And the guide has seen fish right and left. And I was like, okay, better to stay humble. I mean, you can never, you know, you could have however many triumphs where you're lucky enough for it to work out. But in fishing, you're going to be brought right back down to earth soon enough.
Yeah, the guide is always, we were just, you know, it's always the tip. It's one of the best tips, right? Get a guide, get help, because it's going to save you a lot of time. It sounds like you've quite a bit of, you've done on lots of guide trips. Has that been a big part of your success?
It's funny. I completely agree with you about a guide. And I really advise people if they're starting and they want to get in the sport, like to try to learn with a friend or your sibling or your, you know, start with someone or take your son or daughter out and then hire a guide. When I was really getting into fishing, I was fishing in the Housatonic in Litchfield County, Connecticut, and there was a guide nearby. And I was at that time, God, it was probably $350, which is not a lot now. But then that seemed like so much money to me, and I was just a young guy. And I wish I had done that. It would have solved, you know, to invest one day with a guide or with a friend to pool our money for a guide would have saved me so much time because they would have made things 1,000 times easier. And I didn't do it. And I kind of learned on my own and made like some very humiliating mistakes, even by my standards.
Right.
And that could have been, it makes the learning curve that much faster if you have a guide. But having said that, and like, there are plenty of times where I fish on my own and you're going to struggle. Like some things you just have to learn yourself or you have to internalize yourself, I think. And if you can, it's great to have the guide there, but you've got to navigate certain things and solve certain problems. And I think that's, we can look at that in two ways. You can say, well, that's frustrating. You're like, well, yes, it's hard, but ultimately it's something you overcome. And I do think in the end, your biggest satisfaction will probably come fishing alone. When you did something you didn't think you could do and you did it on your own. And when that happens, especially when you look around and there's nobody there and you're like, no one would believe what just happened. This is a great thing. This is a special moment. And to have that for yourself, I mean, that's a great thing.
Right. That's awesome. What is, if you think back, let's go back to when you first got started in fly fishing, you know, before that example you talked about there, what would be a tip you would give your beginner self back in the day?
I grew up on a cabin, or we had a cabin and we still have it in Wisconsin. And there were two older men who I've written about in The Optimist in the first chapter, named Carter and Dave, who were my grandfather's age and were legendary fishermen. And I was, my grandfather said, well, you got to go fishing with Carter and Dave. These guys are the best. And I was too, I mean, I already had a grandfather. I was, you know, 17 years old. I didn't want to like hang out with these old guys. You know, they're probably only 65. But to me, I was like these ancient humans. And man, do I ever wish I fished with them when I was younger. If you have a chance to fish with an older person or a person who's good and you think for whatever reason, maybe you don't get along or your politics are different or you just, you don't want to be with an old guy, my goodness, get on the water with them. You never know. These men were somewhat, I don't know, difficult. They were old, you know, crusty son of a guns who got into plenty of kind of probably emotional disagreements with their family over the years. But when they were on the water, they were so great. They were just happy to have someone with them. When I finally did go out with them in my 20s and they were really generous with their advice. They were patient with me. And only later did I realize how patient they were with me. They were at elite level and I was at, you know, beginner level. But they brought me along and I learned so much from them. And I think you want to be open to learning. And that does mean probably making mistakes. And if you can hire a guide or you can be with someone, you got to put yourself out there. It's not going to happen any other way. And I think the sooner you get beyond that kind of that concern, which is a very human to be, no one wants to make an ass of themselves. I still don't want to, like, if you're trying to make a good, you know, double hand cast across the Skeena, or the people fishing right nearby, want to make it good or whatever. And, but I think you've got like everyone, there's a sympathy among anglers, or there should be, or I like anglers who are, can realize that we've all made our mistakes and hopefully we're making progress and trying our best to get to a better spot. So if you have a chance to go out with someone, I would completely do it. And related to that is to not be so hard on yourself. Like these, you're going to get like into tangles and knots and lose fish. And it isn't, everyone turns to the guide or whoever's with them. Was that my fault? What did I do wrong? What did I do? What did I do? And it's like, these things happen. There's no conclusive answer. Sometimes you can learn something from it. Sometimes it's about accepting that you don't have control over it. And the sooner you accept that you'd have less control over everything, you'll probably be happier as a, when you're fishing. And to be honest, you'll probably be happier in your life.
Yeah, nice. Those are awesome. And I think, yeah, you mentioned, you know, these older guys, you kind of did have your guide early, or a couple of guys, right? They were kind of like guides early on to get you going. And I love the, you know, don't be hard on yourself, because that's a great point. What about the, we mentioned brands a little bit. Maybe give us a couple of brands that you really love. Who are right now out there or in the past that you love?
Well, have you seen this Emerger fly fishing? This is a man in Colorado who makes these beautiful.
Emerger. He builds the bags.
Yeah. So I was so intrigued by this because it was just a man. I don't know if he was a guide too, but he just started to make fly fishing bags. And if you email him or call him, like, he answers the phone and then he makes you a bag. I'm like, this is incredible. I love just the fact that I like that scale. I like that it's one person and he makes these beautiful kind of heavy duty canvas bags that keep their shape so they hold fly boxes. And I thought that was just absolutely delightful. And I use that bag all the time. And I think it's really a great thing. And I like people who make stuff, and you're talking about something that's pretty much in the old style, but it really works well. And that's really good. I mean, I'm friends with the people at Orvis, and so I crank out my Helios 3 and I'm very happy with it.
Yeah, and how's the Orvis? Let's hear that. Give us a style critique on, because Orvis is known. I mean, they have some hunting, right? And they have clothing. Like, well, what's their, give us a critique on them.
I love Orvis. I think there was a little bit of a, controversy when they put that white strip at the bottom of their Helios 3 rods.
It was smart though.
Because then you recognize them. And I think and I told them, I was like, can we just make one that doesn't have that? and they sort of, so a couple of my friends there were laughing and they're like, just use a Sharpie if it really bothers you. And basically we know what we're doing, leave us alone. And I'm just used to it. But, I also like, and I love their old CFO reels, like the original, like very old fashioned reels, but I like their Mirage reel that no one seems, I don't know if people don't know about it or because the Helios is such a huge deal, but the Mirage reel by Orvis is my like unknown thing made by a famous company that I like, that I think is like, I love the weight, I love the mechanism. So I'm big on the Mirage and I'm like, come on guys, let's get this out in the world. Everyone knows the Helios, no one knows the Mirage. But I mean, I use all sorts of weird stuff from the old, I have an old Loomis reel that I got when I started, you know, back from the 90s. That's like very simple pawn click reel. That's, I like things that generally look more old fashioned probably, but as long as it works, I'm fine with it. But I get caught up, and I was in Urban Angler yesterday buying a different leader, different Rio leader for bone fishing, because they're like, this will help you if you need to quick load while you're waiting. And I'm like, okay, sucker. I went right into the store. And also, actually, one other thing about reels, I'm obsessed with this company called Anderson with two S's. It's a Swedish reel company had never heard of, but my friend who's Scottish, you know, they have kind of keep things separate from what we have over here. And you can order a large Arbor Anderson reel directly from their factory for a few hundred dollars. They DHL it right to your door. And if you need a more budget option, that Mirage I mentioned is pretty expensive. If for guys looking for, or women looking for a kind of their first bonefish reel, they don't want to kind of commit to, you know, something that's $800 for goodness sake. The Anderson reel is, I've had good luck with it, and I've actually used it for salmon, and I've recommended it to my friends, and they use it for all sorts of things. So there's a little gear talk.
Yeah, that is gear talk. Well, I will highlight the wax canvas. We did have a podcast with Chris Freeman from in episode 301 with Emerger Fly Fishing.
Oh, really? Oh, great. Oh, my God. You're all over it.
Yeah, we do a lot of, we actually, again, shout out to all of our listeners. Whenever somebody has a guest or a topic and they want to hear that brand, I just leave the door open. If they reach out to me, I'll do my best to put it together. So
that's so nice.
So it was a cool one. And yeah, and I know on that episode, people loved it because I think some people checked out and purchased some of his stuff. It's what would you call that? His kind of the canvas bag. Like, do you call that a bag?
Yeah, it's like a wading hip bag that's fairly substantial for people who, I mean, this is where like I'll go for a heavier thing that I like. I wear wading. It's for people who probably carry 6 or 8 fly boxes, which they probably don't need. But also there's a very clever design where there's this, you can just jam your net into the back of it because there's sort of an open bottom that exactly holds a net upside down. And that is just the coolest thing. So that's for people who don't want a technical, you know, super lightweight waterproof sling bag. I was really happy with that. And there's something about going directly to the person who makes it. While I was salmon fishing recently, actually, I saw this insane Norwegian fisherman, like totally obsessed. This guy fishes all over. You can just tell it looks like he just climbed a mountain, for goodness sake. I'm like, what are these reels? And they're like made by someone in Glasgow, famous to a small group of people who makes very fancy salmon reels, but like he doesn't have a website. He sort of has a Facebook page and you contact him and then he just makes it for you. And, you know, it costs a fortune. But I was like, I love this idea of a few people know what it is, and then you track it down from the person who makes it, and then he makes whatever, whether it's a bag or a reel for you. And I think that's the intimate personal side of fishing that I really love.
Perfect. Perfect. Cool, David. Well, I think we'll leave it there. I could pick your brain all day about this, but all this good stuff. But we'll send everybody out and check out The Believer, A Year in the Fly Fishing Life. And that's a Simon & Schuster, right? That's your publisher on this one?
Yeah, exactly. It's technically Scribner, but Scribner is owned by Simon & Schuster.
Oh, gotcha.
All the emails end up at simonandschuster.com.
Yeah, I see. I'm just on the website. I'm seeing it says Simon & Schuster celebrating 100 years. So we got a milestone here.
Yes.
But cool. Well, I appreciate all your time. We'll be in touch here and looking forward to seeing that book when it gets out. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Dave. Really appreciate it.
All right. Are you like me and a little more fired up to get your game back on? If you are, you can check in with David, check out the book, and check out some of his older books and some of his writings out there on men's style. Definitely love his style. Who doesn't love, like we talked about today, some wool, a nice, that classic look, you know what I mean? So check out David if you get a chance. One shout out before we get out of here, shout out to you. And if you get a chance, and if you haven't subscribed or followed this podcast yet, and you're on Apple Podcasts, you can do that right now. If you're new to this podcast, just click that plus button upper right. That will follow the show and will assure that you get that next episode delivered right into your app, and you will see it coming. And right now, I'm not even sure what's coming up next. We are trying to get caught up on things. So I'm excited to be getting this one together. And I just want to let you know that I appreciate you for stopping by today. And I definitely hope you have a great afternoon, a great evening, or a great morning wherever you are in the world. And I appreciate you for stopping by, checking out the show today.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.